Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Big Smoke. And welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Australian slang for a big city. Big Smoke is a big city, such as Melbourne. It's also what was pouring from Max Verstappen's car this weekend. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Energized. Just so happy to have something different to talk about.
Absolutely. Danny O'Dwyer is on assignment again this week. So he will be joining us, I believe, next week. So stick around for your favorite Irish co-host. If you are new to this podcast, there's usually three of us, but a very warm welcome to you anyway. We are happy to have you. If you're new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode, which assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it is episode 257. Also, this show would not be possible without our audience at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release new ad-free versions of the podcast, along with bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you would like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. This month is a Drive to Survive month. We've taken the first half of season six for March, and as soon as April rolls around, we will post the second half of Drive to Survive. Spoilers, I won't say anything except to say that our opinions maybe of the first and second half of the seasons are different. But a special shout out to our title sponsors over on Patreon. Get Rich or Die Ryan, Agave ATX, Siphus Training, Turf SCS, at Team Blackjack, Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, at Talking Autos, Olivia Evans, TelemetryDeck.com, FTC, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foot, Abdullah Althani, MasterCard, Venmo, JC Racing, F1 Team, Abraham Getchell, The Space Above Us Podcast, Bunny Crimes Appreciates the 14 Hours of Sleep, Snigs, Alex Goucher, not Alice Goucher, that's a... They did Feed My Frankenstein and No More Mr. Nice Guy, you know. Max Voltar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, William Rumpf, Irvine Clinical Research, Lachlan the Maddened Man, and Jason Kelly. We've got quite a race to talk about here, Rob. So what do you say we hop right into it, starting with the grid? Not a surprise, perhaps. At the front here, pole position, Max Verstappen. What may be a surprise is right beside him, second place, first row, Carlos Sainz, 2 weeks after abdominal surgery, puts it right next to the championship defender.
I mean, I know it's laparoscopic, folks, but you probably wouldn't catch me wanting to climb into one of those things and then get buffeted around by the G's. That close to a surgery. I'm pretty sure you're still rocking stitches in a few places.
Yeah. Third place, Lando Norris, followed by Charles Leclerc in fourth. Oscar Piastri, the first of the Australians in the grid, lining up for this Australian Grand Prix in fifth. Sergio Perez qualified third, but was penalized three grid places for impeding another driver during qualifying. I believe it was Hulkenberg. So he will start from sixth. George Russell in seventh. Yuki Tsunoda in eighth. Lance Stroll ninth. And Fernando Alonso, who went into the gravel in his first run in Q3 at a site that we will return to as it pertains to Fernando Alonso later in the race. Lewis Hamilton will line up 11th, bumped from Q3 by one Lance Stroll, which, you know, it's been a rough streak, let's say, of late for Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton. 12th place, Alex Albon. The only Williams, Rob, in this race to take the start.
So he wrecked his car in pre-practice two, was it?
I believe it was the first one.
But either way, totaled his car.
Yes.
And Williams does not have a spare. And I say does not because we are not out of the woods for this. This is where we reveal, like, kind of, and we'll have a story we're going to talk about again, like, kind of how winging a prayer Williams is right now. But Williams not only doesn't have a spare car, didn't have a spare car at the race this weekend. They don't have a spare car for the next several races. Like, they've got, they were talking about this during, they ended up talking about this during the race, but, like, Williams is going to replace the lost car, but I think that was supposed to be their spare that they've got. So, like, they're going to, like, go through this next leg of the championship, you know, like, while the championship's out in Asia, without any margin for error. Like, if this happens again, they're going to have to bump Logan Sargeant again from a car because they don't have the spare chassis and equipment just to, like, kit out another car and have to run during the race. Now, it kind of bugged me. I'm curious how you felt about this. Like, maybe I'm getting, like, just, I don't know, tired of F1 commentary or overly sensitive to this, but, like, it started, I hate it when they try to create storylines or drama when I just don't think there's any reasonable way you can argue that there's that much drama. And that's what I felt they were doing with some of the stuff with Logan Sargeant, where it was like, you know, talking about what a hard thing it was, how difficult it was to ask a driver and what a sign of, like, not disrespect, but, like, clearly, like, showing the pecking order over at Williams, that Sargeant was asked to give up his chassis. And I'm sitting there like, yeah, of course. Like, I don't understand. First of all, Logan totaled a ton of cars last year, so I am pretty sure that, like, in terms of karma, he would understand that, like, if the cookie crumbles the other way, you know, he might be asked to, you know, in fairness, just give up a car. But also, he's the junior driver. Alex was a pretty reliable generator of points for a team like Williams last year. I just don't think there was any, like, I'm sure it sucks to travel to a race and then, like, not get to go, but I don't know. It felt to me like commentators, like, kept trying to make something out of this, and I just couldn't fathom being in, like, Logan Sargeant's shoes or, like, at Williams and feeling like it's freighted with this many implications.
Yeah, I think, I think it's probably a case of, and this is something that I do think the commentators are guilty of, is really latching on to one story and just kind of hounding it, you know, flogging it until it is dead. I think, though, that at least the emotions are there's some kernel of truth to that. So, you know, Vowles said, James Vowles, team principal of Williams, said, this decision to put Albon in Sargeant's car to give a maximum chance for points. This decision was not made lightly. This is from F1.com. And we cannot thank Logan enough for his graceful acceptance, demonstrating his dedication to the team. He's a true team player. Logan said, called this the hardest moment I can remember in my career. And I can understand that. You know, like, you're a driver. All you want to do is drive. I imagine that this is, you know, probably the apex of those moments when a driver is told to move aside for his teammate, right? Like, yeah, you get it. It's for the betterment of the team. And some drivers have no problem doing that. We'll talk about Oscar Piastri doing that in this race. Some drivers have a hard time doing it, and, you know, it's circumstantial as well. But I think this is sort of the just the, you know, the yeah, the most intense version of that. But it can't be easy. I would say as a driver.
It can't be, but I certainly I saw that quote from Logan, and I certainly thought if I were in his shoes, I would also make a meal out of it. I would also be like, just because you don't want to give way too easily, you want there to, you know, feel like, hey, I'm doing everyone a solid by being a trooper here, but like it does suck.
That's something like, you can in your back pocket, right? Like, remember when I did that for you guys?
Yeah, but let's be real. You're telling me that this seriously wasn't worse than when he threw that car into the wall at the Netherlands, you know, in what had otherwise been a really good qualifying performance. Like, you're like, you know what I mean? It's like, here he sacrificed for the team. He's had way worse moments as an F1 driver in his career. Like, way more like, what are you doing here, kid? Wow, you really wrecked things for the team again. So I don't know. I found that kind of, I found like some of the stuff that was made out of this kind of funny. But also, I think it's like, especially for people who've been around the sport for ages, I think things like the absurd court politics of Ferrari and who, you know, what Michael did to Rubens and then later what Alonso did to Felipe. I mean, this stuff looms so large that it's almost like for commentators of a certain vintage, it has like eliminated their ability to reasonably analyze what are pretty clear, pragmatic team decisions. But I do think it also helps that, as we talked about last week, Val seems like a guy whose decision-making process is transparent enough, and he is clear enough, like, what he means by certain things, that he is not going to backdoor demote somebody or marginalize them at the team just to avoid, like, coming out and saying, like, here's our number one. Like, I am sure Logan and Alex have a very clear understanding of, like, where things stand. That probably makes it a hell of a lot easier when you have to tell someone they got to take one for the team.
Yeah, I mean, Val's thing is that he's data-driven, right? And so this is purely, he can fall back on, like, this is a mathematical decision. But yeah, I mean, you don't see it very often, a team not having a spare chassis around. But yeah, so Alex, the lone Williams, lines up 12th, Valtteri Bottas in 13th, followed by Kevin Magnussen, Esteban Ocon in 15th, into Q2 in that Alpine. He was elated to not be knocked out. Nico Hülkenberg lines up 16th, followed by Pierre Gasly. Daniel Ricciardo, the other Australian, had gotten into Q2, but had his time deleted for track limits. And then Zhou Guan Yu, who did qualify 19th, but in the process went over a curb and damaged his front wing, which required his team to fit a new one of a different spec, meaning that he will start from the pit lane. Rob, do you want to take us through the start, or I can?
Please do. Like, I don't have too many notes from the start, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, because stuff starts happening with Max real fast.
Yeah, so it's from, on lap one at least, it's clean through turn one with Verstappen leading off the line well. Russell does get around Perez at turn three for sixth place, which with a move that I thought was pretty good. And then lap two, Sainz closes on Verstappen on the back straight and sweeps around him as they head through that turn 9 and 10 complex, which was surprising. I was kind of like looking around going, is this way different than that? Because there were sort of like rumblings of, I don't know, Red Bull's not, you know, looking 100% dominant in practice, right?
But they say that all the time to try and like trick you into be like, if you're in the commentary business, you got to trick people into being like, don't change that dial. Red Bull hasn't looked right this whole weekend. And like most of the time you hear that, that turns out to be not true or not true enough to erase the, you know, few tenths that Max tend to have in his back pocket. And then, you know, Red Bull tend to be downplay their chances a little bit. And it looked, at least at the start, like it was going to go according to plan where Max drives off. But yeah, as you pointed out, like he didn't. Like I was startled there, like lap two, where it's like, the margin's not getting pulled out, and actually signs are like rapidly closing in on him. But then we get that delayed radio message around that same time, where Max is radioed back to the Red Bull pit. And I think it's like, I think the message plays like right after the pass, but that means that the radio message, I think, came before the pass. But it's where he's talking about like he just lost the rear end, and it was real weird.
Yeah, and Brundle actually pointed out that he, Verstappen, like twitched in the preceding corners, which allowed Signs to pull up faster. So but all that was just sort of conjecture. We understand two laps later, as smoke appears out the back of Verstappen's car, followed shortly thereafter by fire, that well, I guess I'll finish out here. What we see is that he goes into the pits. It's clear that the issue is with the right rear brake pad. And we get a cool replay of him coming into the pits, and something just like explodes out the side of his car, which, boy, good thing that wasn't in the pit lane, because that may have hurt somebody. But in the interview with Verstappen afterward, he explains that the brake on that wheel, the rear right, had been engaged from the start of the race, basically like he was driving with the handbrake on. So that's what it takes to pass Max Verstappen, is he leaves the handbrake on. And to be clear, it's not something that he did. It was a technical issue.
It does make that radio message kind of odd. If they were seeing that the brake was stuck early, that it would be kind of weird that he's sending a message talking about, gosh, lost the car there for a second. That was strange if you know, they were struggling with this issue from the line. But yeah, it was a really weird looking incident, because it was throwing the blue smoke you associate with engines, but you could tell that it was coming off the inside rim of the tire. It was a very strange thing. But yeah, it took him off the board really, really quickly. And so suddenly it was Ferrari in the proverbial catbird seat, you know, with this race, and Max nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, we should say it was a terminal issue, and Verstappen did retire from the race. The first time he has retired in 43 races since actually Australia of 2022, thus ending his bid for another 10 race wins in a row. Yeah, leaving Sainz in the lead, followed by Norris, Leclerc, and Piastri. The next to go out is Verstappen's 2021 championship rival, Lewis Hamilton, who retires with an engine failure on lap 17. After which we get a virtual safety car that benefits one Fernando Alonso, who had not pitted at that point, along with Hülkenberg and Gasly.
That was the most incredible. Like, just this is a guy who has had accidents arranged for him, and this one still like could not have worked out better. This was still up there in terms of fortunate things to fortunate timings for Fernando Alonso. But yeah, it wasn't like it was ever a good weekend for Lewis, the way the car was behaving. But you know, I think at this point now, at least once or twice a race, the Mercedes drivers will just get on the radio to comment about how much faster another car seems. Like, boy, that thing's a rocket ship. Look at that. Yeah. They're treating the old men like at a highway rest stop, right? Like, woof, that baby was cooking. Like, becoming spectators of their own race. But yeah, it doesn't seem like, you know, I feel like last week and heading into this weekend, everyone at Mercedes was trying to be really measured about like how things are going. You know, Lewis talking about like, it's just a much better car. It, you know, it doesn't have the evil characteristics of the previous design. But I think that sort of measured positivity is also running its course a little bit.
Yeah. Lap 18, Ocon pits with actually the same smoking area as Verstappen had. But the team sends him back out after his pit stop, saying that a tear-off had gotten stuck in the brake duct, the sort of sticky thing across the visor that drivers have, you know, stacked on there, and they can tear it off. This seems to happen a non-trivial number of times, and it is, in fact, not the last time that we'll bring it up in this race.
It's a Brundle hobby horse that they should
really
be forced
is.
To have some sort of like disposal, which I'm curious to think he's probably right. Like the fact that these things are routinely now compromising cars behind them, they should maybe create a little affordance to have a little waste slot for the tear-offs in the cockpit.
Yeah. Perez, who had been trying to retake the place on Russell that he lost at the opening lap, pitted a few laps before the virtual safety car, but crucially six laps after Russell, and by lap 21 had made it back up to him, getting Russell at the end of the back straight into turn 9. And a few laps later passes Alonso for fifth in the same place. So Perez moving up the field. We haven't talked about McLaren too much yet, but Piastri pitted on lap 10, I believe, to cover Leclerc, while Norris stayed out for five more laps, which meant that Piastri effectively undercut Norris when Norris pitted. So when Norris comes back out, he's behind Leclerc, or sorry, Piastri in fourth. But with those new tires, I assume, McLaren decides to swap the cars on lap 27 to let Norris chase down Leclerc, and Piastri does so without complaint. What did you make of this, Rob?
It just seems like some of these things, it's like it's so clearly the right call,
yep.
Especially given how tricky it is keeping these tires and like the right window to have pace to maybe set up an attack on someone else, that wasting that energy on a teammate is just so foolish that, you know, I think if, I think any place like a team has run things in such a way that the drivers can't be, they can't be normal about these calls. Like anytime the second, like, you know, someone's coming up behind on a different strategy, the second that turns into a debate over the radio, like, I think you've really lost control of your ability to execute team strategy. And it's shocking how many teams tolerate that as the status quo, where you're going to have like a hostage negotiation live on the air when, you know, the time those tires are going to be in their window can sometimes be measured in a few laps.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when that happens to ponder why it's happening. Is it, you know, can you always chalk it up to the hot-headedness or egotism of a driver? I don't think so. I think you can, especially recently, in recent years, there's been cause for drivers to doubt their teams. Most recently, like in the past few seasons, we haven't necessarily seen too much of that.
Have we seen the shoe on the other foot with Norris that much?
Sorry?
Have we seen the shoe on the other foot that much with Norris?
I don't think so. Not that I can recall.
He was always ahead of Daniel, pretty much. So he's always comfortably beating the hell out of him. And then Piastri's come in as a clear junior. Sometimes positionally he's ahead, but like when they've had to make way, they've been able to. Because I am curious, because sometimes I do get the sense that like Norris is a little less secure about that. And, you know, will be a bit more prickly about, you know, team orders coming in. But Piastri,
and he
just
does
seems...
have that, sorry, he does have that relationship, right, that long-running relationship with the team. I can see him, you know, adopting a sort of, what are you going to do, fire me kind of attitude. I don't know that he would do that, but it's I guess more conceivable than the newbie Piastri. Leclerc, for his part, pits on lap 35 and comes out just ahead of Perez and Alonso and does a good job of keeping them behind. Lap 41, Tsunoda gets by Gasly with a great late lunge down the inside for ninth place. I think that was that turn six or so? And then we get a potentially scary moment with Hülkenberg defending from Albon with some pretty late moves. I predict this is not the last that we will see this season of Williams tangling with Haas cars.
At every point matters so much to these teams.
Yes.
Like, yeah, I think you're right. It's going to be, you know, we've talked about before, sometimes drivers keep running afoul of each other just because like the way their hardware is matching up and their own race pace matches up. the way like Hamilton and Albon kept tripping over each other when Albon was at Red Bull. But yeah, these two teams, just in terms of pace, I think they're going to keep running into each other. And, you know, I think Magnussen certainly is he's the harder of the two racers. But, you know, Hülkenberg is not a pushover either.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to keep happening.
Yeah, contrast that with, like, Zhou and Bottas, and I don't see them as formidable opponents for some reason. They don't feel that way to me.
I think that's because their races keeps getting mooted in the pits.
It's
like I think you would see some fireworks, except that, like, hey, shout outs to Valtteri Bottas. He was driving a great race. Like, he was having a really good race weekend coming together. And yet again, cross-threaded wheel nut. I think here, not only that, like, I think they had one that was like, they had another cross-thread at this race, but then also they instituted a team rule that they were going to do slow tire changes to deal with this, like, chronic cross-threading they've got.
Right.
And, you know, Ted Kravitz was explaining, and there's an article over at The Race about this, like what's going on with Sauber pit stops. And their explanation is there's a thermal issue with, you know, doing the wheels. Like, it's not coming up in practice, and it wasn't coming up in testing, but running at race pace, the heat coming off the wheel nut assembly and the guns they're using, all the guns are bespoke. It's causing these like lockups and jams in the pits. And like, on the one hand, I'm really sympathetic to that. Like, that sounds annoying. But also, I feel like the wheel nut is largely a solved problem in F1. For it to become this chronic, for a team to like have it go this bad, I don't know. This to me is like when your favorite appliance manufacturer starts swapping in the plastic parts without telling anyone. And suddenly everyone's like blender turns to shit. This is kind of how it feels, where it's like, you know, they're not owning up to the fact that, yeah, we are using, sorry, our wheel guns are made of plastic now. And the heat of the nut just like shears off the threads. I don't know. It just doesn't seem, this is not a good problem to have.
No, it's not. And I wonder, I've got to imagine that this is not like, it's not a quick fix, right? Otherwise, they would have just swapped out this part, right? The fact that it's happening over and over again means that it is an entire assembly that they are having to redesign and remanufacture. And, you know, meanwhile, they're just having to go out and race with whatever they got. So,
And how many teams, like, so there's safety margin here. And I think I'm pretty sure they still had a wheel get stuck, but their safety margin was to have 5-second pit stops. How many cars, not the Red Bull, can, say it's a two-stop race, right? How many cars can just spot 6 seconds stationary and have that not translate to, like, meaningful falls down the order? I don't think there's many.
Yeah.
Like, you're effectively, like, these pit stops are taking them out of the running regardless of what the drivers do. I think Valtteri is quietly like showing quite a bit of pace this year, and Joe's had moments as well.
Yeah, it's if I'm reading this information on racefans.net correctly, Joe had a 9-second pit stop and Valtteri had a 19-second pit stop. Not the best. Let's see, where were we? Yes. So Magnussen, speaking of Williams and Haas, spends quite a few laps trying to pass Albon and eventually does so down into turn 9 on lap 45. That will prove to be a pivotal pass. And as we are winding down, enjoying Sainz's trip to the top of the podium, we cut on the last lap to Russell's onboard as he's in the middle of a crash. And, you know, when the horizon isn't level, it's scary. Thankfully,
I thought we were catching him mid-tumble.
Yes. On replay, the crash does not look as bad. He skids a little heading into turn 6, which he then corrects.
Clear. We'd seen him trying to close the gap on Alonso for several laps. Like he was in a good attacking position, probably had the better pace overall, but the Mercedes is not a quick car in the straight line. And so he could bring it closer during the corners, but was not ever able to like set up an attack. And we'd sort of just, that was the last we'd seen of it. And then, yeah, it looks like what happened here, because on replay, to me it looked weird immediately. The minute we saw Russell's in car, it looked a little bit weird to me. My first thought when he had the accident, having not seen what happened, I thought he pulled another, was it Vegas or Singapore last year, where he just follows Norris into the wall.
I think it was Singapore.
Yeah, but... like, I thought he'd done it again, where it was just, like, him fumbling another late race attack. And maybe there's people out there who do feel that's still what happened, but that was my suspicion when it first happened. I was gonna go down as get another entry in the ledger of, like, George Russell maybe not having the complete, like, package of a high-end F1 driver when it comes to, like, these moments in the clutch. But when we got his in-car... the first thing you see is obviously he loses all the air off his front wing as he comes up behind Alonso and just runs wide onto a very narrow, gravelly runoff, on the outside of a corner and clips the wall and then sort of gets launched sideways. The wheels kind of separate from the chassis and are held on by the tethers and he goes for a ride. But on that replay, like, Alonso looked really slow. It was like it's like when you're coming up on a distressed car or, like, you know, really off the pace lap traffic. It looked a little weird to me, just in terms of how slow Alonso was moving. Given the pace that Alonso had to maintain throughout that duel to keep ahead of Russell, I assume maybe Alonso was recovering from his own near miss. Maybe he was also at the limit. But seems like the FIA, it seems like the stewards, didn't feel this was a normal one.
No. So they, after the race, so let's, this is, we get a virtual safety car. This is the final lap. So the race ends under virtual safety car, despite Russell's frantic calls for a red flag. Which are frankly kind of harrowing to listen to in the team radio.
Because he's in the middle of the track.
He's like, you need to stop this race immediately. Which that's a different conversation. So after the race, the stewards handed a drive-through penalty to Alonso, though because the race was over, that was converted to a 20-second time penalty, dropping him from 6th to 8th. And their reasoning was that after having heard from both drivers that Alonso slowed intentionally, and they point out 100 meters earlier than he ever had into that corner, and irrespective of his intentions, it was a potentially dangerous move given the circumstances, and therefore the 20-second time penalty. Alonso stated that he was just trying to get a better exit, quote, sacrificing entry speed to have good exits from corners is part of the art of motorsport. These quotes are from race fans. The subtext here, though, is that the DRS detection point is just after turn 6. So if Alonso could somehow get a greater than 1 second buffer to Russell, then Russell would be less likely to pass him on this, the final lap of the race. So if he could somehow... I don't know if the intent here is to back up, to check up on Russell, to make Russell check up on Alonso, or maybe it's a double win scenario, two birds scenario, where Alonso gets a better exit from that corner than Russell would, thus increasing the gap. And then if, you know, Russell has to check up, all the better. Russell says, I was half a second behind him and approaching the corner, and then suddenly he slowed up very dramatically and got back on the power. I just wasn't expecting it, and it caught me by surprise. What do you think of all this, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, like, You know, again, this is a level of racing that I can't totally, like, I can't sort of put myself in the car. To me, it did look weird. Just like, for, like, even Alonso's explanation of you know, sacrificing entry speed to get exit speed, I'm not entirely sure that meshes with the sort of profile of that corner. He was over. It's sort of a sweeper, right? And he's over on the inside. I don't know. It just doesn't. That's not the kind of corner where you can sacrifice a ton of entry speed. It feels like to me. And then have that, like, come back your way on exit. It's kind of a weird thing. But also, I tend to believe when the stewards pull car telemetry data and they see something really incriminating, I tend to believe them, right? Like, when you have something really abnormal pop up in like, the driver's inputs and it looks like you're brake checking somebody, you might be brake checking somebody. I am inclined to think that because someone, like, so often you hear, like, F1 drivers going back and back and back. To race hard safely requires a lot of trust. There has to be a degree of predictability in what the other driver is going to do, and that wasn't predictable. I don't think if you're George, you foresee Alonso coming off it that fast in a part of course that is that narrow. And George had to go into crash evasion mode, you know, rather than making a sort of tactical move. Right. And also, just because of aerodynamics, he loses the ability to control the car, just because, like, he's, you know, because of where this is all unfolding. So I am inclined to believe that, like, they got Alonso, you know, working in the gray a little bit. I think if I'm Mercedes, I'm still looking at this. You know, it's not a black mark for George, but, like, it might be a gray mark, right? Where you kind of want, I want to see you avoid this. I want to see you. Yeah. I want to see this not turn into a DNF.
Yeah. Well, the Fs in this race were Carlos Sainz on top. He finishes the race out under virtual safety car and gets the win. I saw a stat that said in the past 11 months, the only drivers to win races have been Carlos Sainz and Max Verstappen.
Smooth operator, baby.
That's right. Charles Leclerc in second, Lando Norris in third. And interestingly, after the race, if we recall that decision to run Norris longer, according to this Race Fans article, that was not the plan. Quote, McLaren's attempt to get Norris ahead of Leclerc ran into trouble when the Ferrari driver came in on the very lap they intended for their driver.
I wondered about that.
Yeah, this is Norris talking now. The lap we were going to undercut, he boxed. So then, again, you have to go off and do a kind of different strategy. We got close in the second stint. I got very close. If I boxed, I think I would have I would have undercut. But he boxed, so I missed that opportunity. I think our pace was not as good as Carlos, but probably better than Charles. So I think, if I was honest, maybe we missed out a little bit on an opportunity to be P2 today. That would have been very interesting.
Yeah, that was an interesting moment in the pits there. You saw the two pit crews come out, and then Norris goes flying past the pit entrance. Real quick, I just also wanted to call out again. Yet another race where Sainz seems to be calling the strategy from the cockpit and doing quite a good job. Like, he seems to have a very good sense of, this is how I want this race to unfold, including, like, sort of advocating for, like, this is what is going to make me most comfortable, right? He was calling out, like, I do not want to come out of the pits in a fight. You know, let me stay out and create my own buffer, willing to maybe risk being exposed to the undercut a little bit, because he was out in clean air and he didn't seem afraid of the undercut. Whereas I think every other strategist on the grid was a little bit. He was willing to chance it and stay out there a little bit. So, like, you know, his wins tend to feel like quality wins, where you know, he's doing a very good job. Win or lose, we're going to do the race that I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a very useful thing. That's a useful set of guardrails to put around the Ferrari pit wall at this time, as they're sort of getting that operation righted. I am curious what you make of... To me, this still feels like lightning struck Max and took him off the board. And I am less convinced that this was Ferrari's race. There's been some, you know, a couple websites are like, here's the new upgrades or the new approach that letting Ferrari, you know, steal this win. And like, Max's brake froze. Like, basically, that's what happened. But I was struck by this, who was it? Was it Perez saying afterwards?
Yeah,
that there was just no way Max was going to win.
Yeah, so I'll finish off the top five here. Oscar Piastri fourth, and Sergio Perez fifth. He did say after the race he actually also had a tear off get lodged somewhere in his car on the floor. Apparently right after he passed Alonso on lap 26. But on top of that, he also said, and this from race fans, when asked whether Ferrari would have won even if Verstappen hadn't retired, he said, absolutely yes. We already saw last year in a track like this, for example, Vegas, a front limited track, Ferrari was a lot stronger than us. So we just couldn't look after the front tires. Now, he obviously has a vested interest in saying that, because that would explain his
no mortal
fifth place.
Man could have kept up with right. Carlos Sainz today.
Right. But yeah, thought that was interesting.
I don't know. I tend to think that if Max's car is 100%, maybe we would have had a hell of a fight, but I don't think Ferrari, you know, we saw the qualifying. It just didn't look like Ferrari had any sort of, you know, real pace advantage they could count on versus the Red Bull. So, I'm not looking at this as, even though it's done exciting things to the standings tables, I'm not looking at this as like a season reset.
Yeah. Lance Stroll in sixth, Yuki Tsunoda seventh, Fernando Alonso eighth after that penalty, Nico Hülkenberg ninth, and Kevin Magnussen in 10th, double points for Gene Haas and team. Alex Albon missed out on a point by less than a second. He comes home in 11th. Daniel Ricciardo, 12th. Pierre Gasly, 13th. Valtteri Bottas and Zhou Guanyu in 14th and 15th. And finally, Esteban Ocon ahead of the DNFs of George Russell, Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen, and the did not start of Logan Sargeant. With neither George Russell nor Lewis Hamilton finishing, Mercedes ended a 62-race scoring streak, which tied their previous best scoring streak. These stats from F1.com. Their last failure to score points was Azerbaijan 2021. This is also Hamilton's worst ever start to a season, with a 7th, 9th, and DNF. His previous worst three races were at McLaren in 2007, where he went DNF 6th and 7th. And if not for Alonso's penalty, Mercedes would be 5th in the Constructors' Championship right now. And that's the Australian Grand Prix. And that is it for the race recap. We are going to take a quick break, and then we will be back with the news. All right, Rob, we're back with the news. A lot of FIA-oriented stuff to talk about this week. So Mohamed Bensoulaym is the president of the FIA, which is the governing body of F1 and many other international motorsports. And just to sort of reset here, a whistleblower a few weeks ago alleged that Bensoulaym did two things. He, one, pressured stewards to overturn an Alonso penalty at the 2023 Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. And the other alleged action was that Bensoulaym told officials to find a way not to certify the Las Vegas Grand Prix as safe for racing last year. So these claims were brought before the FIA's ethics committee, which after 30 days of inquiry involving 11 witnesses has now issued their verdict, which states After reviewing the results of the inquiries, the ethics committee were unanimous in their determination that there was no evidence to substantiate allegations of interference of any kind involving the FIA president, Mohammed Ben Sulayem. So for some color on this, Autosport has some quotes from RB CEO Peter Beyer, who was formerly the F1 executive director at the FIA. So Bayer, says the FIA are capable because there's elected people who have roles. There's an independent ethics committee. Since when I was there, we've established the compliance officer and whistleblowing hotlines. One thing that we see is the sport has grown massively in a very short amount of time. A lot of people are asking for transparency. I guess we will have to try and understand where we can have transparency, because when it's about individual topics or complaints coming through a whistleblowing hotline, you have to make sure there is absolute guarantee and protection of the people doing the whistleblowing. We have to have confidence in the organization. It's the same when we have a steward's decision or something else. Sometimes we might not like the decisions, but ultimately we have to be happy with the process. Zach Brown is sort of the other end of the spectrum. He's the one calling a lot more for transparency. And, you know, I would say pointing out the fact that this is the FIA Ethics Committee investigating the FIA. Maybe there's something else that could have been done or this could have been arranged differently. Before we move on, Rob, what's your take on all this?
I mean, it was a weird story to begin with. It sort of dovetailed with, you know, Ben Sulayem's reputation as kind of a klutz and a bit of a clown when it comes to how he goes about carrying out the duties of his office. I think, you know, I hear the Bear comments, coming from someone affiliated with Red Bull right now. Right? I mean,
yeah.
I am not sure anyone at that team is going to be casting stones or aspersions on an internal investigation, not like, you know, maybe not being serious enough, about like ferreting out wrongdoing. I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, he has firsthand experience like working in those offices with some of those people. I'm sure that's a valuable perspective, but also I'm not sure anyone at Red Bull is going to, right now, especially go out on the limb and say, well, we need to get a truly independent board in here to investigate what's going on. I don't think it's going to come from Red Bull. And the thing I can't quite parse is just like the stuff about the Vegas certification. It's just weird. You know what I mean? Like some of the stuff that was alleged here, I just don't understand what the play was, except to like throw sand in the gears of FOM. I just don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. But this is not the only ethics thing the FIA has going. And again, to sort of reset this story, Susie Wolf, who's the director of the F1 Academy series and the wife of Mercedes team principal Toto Wolf, was the subject of an FIA inquiry over a conflict of interest, given that her husband runs the Mercedes team. At the time, this was met with incredibly strong pushback from not only the Wolfs and Mercedes, but the other 9 teams of Formula One, who issued identical statements saying that they did not lodge the complaint and have no issue with the Wolfs. 2 days after that, the FIA dropped the investigation. So now, Susie Wolf says that she has filed a, quote, criminal complaint in the French courts in relation to the statements made about me by the FIA last December. The FIA is headquartered in France. Quote, there has still not been any transparency or accountability in the relation to the conduct of the FIA and its personnel in this matter. I feel more than ever it is important to stand up to call out improper behavior and make sure people are held to account. While some may think silence absolves them from responsibility, it does not. So, legal proceedings, Rob. Criminal complaint.
Understand what the criminal. I guess this is a French law thing. Maybe someone who knows can let us know. I don't understand what the criminal complaint would be.
Is this a? I know libel rules can be different in the UK and perhaps
it can be a
in England.
Matter in like in France. I don't know. It's that I'm just going off what I know of like U.S. law, and it just doesn't seem like you'd see a civil complaint maybe about this. And even there, I'm not sure you'd have that much of a case because ultimately, the FIA kind of ham-fistedly did a grand opening, grand closing of an ethics investigation of the Wolves, effectively. But in that, I don't see that they did anything too open, like, not even, like, too openly libelous. I mean, they didn't really spell out what they were investigating in a way that could read as an accusation. And so I'm not entirely sure what the criminal complaint is. But this might be a French law thing that is beyond me.
Well, just to touch on the last thing the FIA has going, sort of a no news update. The woman who accused Christian Horner of inappropriate behavior, a matter which was investigated and then dismissed by Red Bull before the company suspended her, in addition to appealing Red Bull's findings, has lodged an official complaint with the FIA. And as of now, the FIA has declined to say whether it is investigating the matter. And here I'll quote from a BBC article. Meanwhile, over the course of the Bahrain Grand Prix weekend, Ben Sulayem approached Red Bull driver Max Verstappen and said he should make a public statement supporting Horner. Verstappen responded, sources close to the world champion have told BBC Sport, by telling Ben Sulayem he should launch his own investigation into the matter. So
I didn't hear that last part before.
Yeah.
I knew that Sulayem had requested the vote of confidence, with which itself is just wildly out of pocket. Like, who on earth are you to approach someone at Red Bull and tell them, like, you should give Christian Horner a vote of confidence? Boy, talk about, like, if the FIA does investigate this, that investigation doesn't seem like it'll be worth a whole hell of a lot. You know, coming from an office, you know, affiliated with Sulayem, but it's just such a weird request. But the notion that Verstappen retorted with, you know, an exhortation like investigate it yourself is very interesting. But yeah, just a weird decision to just go wade in there.
FIA just having a normal one over the past few months. Speaking of having a normal one, James Vowles, when he came in to run Williams, I think we mentioned something along these lines a few episodes ago, that, you know, he entered this new company, Williams, this team, and, you know, as a team principal, you have to kind of do the full evaluation of, all right, how does everything get done here? Where can we make improvements? And he made some offhanded comment about, like, they don't have any inventory software. And we talked a little bit about that. The Race, the-race.com, has an article that explains exactly what he means. And so these quotes here are from James Vowles talking about the fact that they tracked every part and may still track every part on the car in Microsoft Excel. He says, the Excel list was a joke, impossible to navigate and impossible to update. Take a front wing. A front wing is about 400 different bits. And when you say, I would like one single front wing, please, what you need to kick off is the metallic bits and the carbon bits that make that up. So you need to go into the system and they need to be ordered. Is a front wing more important than a front wishbone in that circumstance? When do they go through? When is the inspection? When you start tracking now hundreds of thousands of components through your organization moving around, an Excel spreadsheet is useless. You need to know where each one of those independent components are, how long it will take before it's complete, how long it will take before it goes to inspection, if there's been any problems with inspections, whether it has to go back again. And once you start putting that level of complexity in which is where modern Formula One is, the Excel spreadsheet falls over and humans fall over, and that's exactly where we are.
I'm trying to work out there. Is he saying that the Excel spreadsheet they were using would have like 20,000 lines in it with all the subcomponents that go into like wings and other bits and bobbins? Or is he saying that like you'd open their Excel sheet and it's like front wing two, you know, order status, yes, no, or something like that.
Right.
Like, and there'd be no data about the rest of those parts. Like, both seem bad. I think we've all worked in places where there are sort of legacy Excels that mm-hmm. exist that, like, it's never closed, right? It stays open on machines that touch it for ages because, right. like, you can't open it, you can't close it. You just, like, go in, you edit it, and, you know, you don't breathe on it. You touch it as little as possible because, like, it's just a sucking chest wound to the memory of the machine. But yeah, I'm really curious if either it was like the equivalent of a bar napkin describing like the various parts you got. Like, you want a wing? Yeah, we got those. You want a you want a side pod? Yeah, we got side pod. Or is it like, all right, time to figure out what's going on with the wing? And we'll have that answer in 15 minutes after the page loads.
Well, I think they were tracking every piece and it was just buckling under the complexity, because they've talked about in the past, like, not knowing where certain parts are. Like, James Vowles goes, where's this? And they have to go physically find it. There's no record of it being anywhere. What they've said basically is that, and I might be pulling this from, I was listening to that podcast that we mentioned a few episodes ago, where he's, I think it's the High Performance Podcast. I went and listened to it. It's fascinating. He's talking about how basically they are having to rip the Band-Aid off with this, because you can imagine, you know, except for the mandated shutdown periods, the F1 team doesn't really stop. They're always building the next car. And so you can't just like say, all right, stop using the Excel spreadsheet, we're using this new thing now. Like, how do you translate all that information and workflow over? They've effectively had to do that and still be making a car at the same time. And that's what's been really, really difficult. And that's why they don't have a third chassis to spare. But they're doing this because going forward, they need to have something sustainable. That's why this Excel spreadsheet, I imagine, has been around for so long, because you just can't replace it easily. He said in that interview that they are not really worrying about 2024, and they're not really even worrying about 2025. They are trying to rip off all the Band-Aids so that when 2026 rolls around and we get the new regulations, that's when they can really hit the ground running. And I like listening to those podcasts. I've been watching all their YouTube stuff because it's fascinating. It's almost like watching a Formula One team boot up from the ground.
I really want the workplace comedy about this starring Tom Hardy as James Vowles, like just a, leaving just the sleek, high performance, super, you know, super corporate tech centric world of Mercedes and going to, well, kind of the place you remember from the Williams documentary, where you have the poor little abandoned Williams brother haunting the spare parts library.
The archive. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and there's a little detail in this piece of the race that I just wanted to call out, that the thing that was complicating this and they were losing time to is people kept fishing around for old parts that wouldn't fit the new car, but maybe with a little tinkering and adapting, they could be made to fit the new car. And I too have had drawers full of like weird, you know, this is like you do a PC build, right? And it's like, you never know. You're going to need a screw that's exactly that like shape and size. So better keep that here. And it kind of sounds like Williams was operating the same way where it's like, well, hang on now. That's a perfectly good nut.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish them luck and I really am enjoying the transparency, speaking of that word, that James Vowles is giving us everyone into this, this weird situation. Speaking of team principals, Rob, Zach Brown.
Yeah. Not big news here, but like he's, despite maybe some moments that imply the contrary during Drive to Survive, Zach Brown very firmly ensconced at McLaren, signed a new contract with McLaren to remain as CEO until 2030. So he is in it now for you know this entire transition to the new formula in 2026. Yeah, like long-term future seems very stable there, and that sort of continues the trend it feels like we have here to long-tenured, long-tenured F1 team principals.
Yeah. All right, that's it for the news. I'll just run down the driver standings as a result of the Australian Grand Prix. Red Bull Racing's Max Verstappen is still on top with 51 points. Right behind him, though, Charles Leclerc with 47. That is maybe as close as they're going to get. Sergio Perez is in third with 46 points. Carlos Sainz in fourth with 40. Oscar Piastri is in fifth with 28 points, followed by his teammate Lando Norris, 1 point behind with 27. George Russell's in seventh with 18. Fernando Alonso has 16. Lance Stroll has 9. And Lewis Hamilton is in 10th place with 8 points. Yuki Tsunoda and Oliver Bearman tied with 6, followed by Nico Hülkenberg with 3 and Kevin Magnussen with 1. The rest of them, Alex Albon, Zhou Guanyu, Daniel Ricciardo, Esteban Ocon, Pierre Gasly, Valtteri Bottas, and Logan Sargeant all have 0. In the constructor standings, Red Bull Racing is on top with 97 points. Ferrari, though, close behind with 93. McLaren is in third with 55. Mercedes in fourth with 26. Aston Martin with 25. RB is in sixth with 6 points. Gene Haas and team have 4 points. And then we've got Williams, Sauber, and Alpine with 0. If you want to join the standings yourself, you can do so by joining our fantasy league, which in the F1 fantasy website's infinite wisdom has decided to rename our league. League 171-035-046, 17313. So, catch it. However, we have the correct standings, it seems, from the Australian Grand Prix. The podium looks thusly. In third place, we have Silly Season Sommelier. In second, Ooh Ferrari Friends, Happy Face Emoticon. And, oh, wow. In first place, this is great. I like this. Flight of the Valtteris.
That's good.
But overall, I don't know if this is intentional. Maybe not, because I see this is happening to multiple other teams. In third place, overall, we have Team 17105055084175. Patrick C's team. In second place, we have Enter Team Name Here X1. And overall, from the Australia podium, we have Ooh Ferrari Friends Happy Face Emoticon with 803 points. Congratulations. My team has dropped to 1,593rd place.
Did somebody DNF perchance?
It's possible, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, you can send us an email if you like, shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/email. So you can also hit us up on the socials using the links in the show notes. That's us around the internet. Now it is time to take it around the world of racing. The World Rally Championship is in Kenya, in Naivasha, for the Safari Rally Kenya this weekend. Formula E is in Tokyo for the Tokyo E-Prix around the Tokyo Big Sight Convention Center, which is, oh wow, we have not only, so we are in the Tokyo Prefecture, but this may be the first time that we are in a ward. We are in the Koto Ward of the Tokyo Metropolis. The NASCAR Xfinity Series is at the Richmond Raceway in Richmond, Virginia, for the Toyota Care 250.
But that ain't the only NASCAR. Also, at the Richmond Raceway, we have the Toyota Owners 400. Sensing a theme here with the old Toyota.
And that's all we got for racing around.
Relatively quiet weekend.
This fine world. It is, yeah. I feel like...
I think a lot of sports car racing was just popping off. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, things look back up to speed next weekend for sure. Final thoughts, I guess, Rob, on Australia.
The Signs fans are eating. Like, they're eating good. Mm-hmm. I think if... You know, I think... There, I know in our community, and I think in a lot of places, there are people who have really felt like Carlos Sainz has not gotten his due, that he has, when given the opportunity to prove he's got the stuff. Like, he proves it. He does execute, and sometimes appears to be more reliable than his, you know, frequently more celebrated teammate. And this is further grist for that mill, right? This, if you feel like this guy got done dirty a bit by Ferrari, and that if anyone should have been retained, it was him. I can see, you know, I think there's gonna be a lot of people coming away from this that are gonna point to this and say, man, this dude came back from a surgery and cleaned house for Ferrari. You know, I do think that there is mounting evidence that this guy's undervalued in F1. Now, I don't know if Ferrari, you know, I can certainly understand why Ferrari might still feel that, long term our chances are better with Charles. But he's going to be somebody's number one driver. And I think he's going to do right by them.
We debated talking about this story, the fact that Helmut Marko is out there saying Tsunoda's been doing well, but he's going to have to still improve if he wants that Red Bull seat. What if Sainz gets that seat? What if he goes back into the Red Bull fold?
I mean, in the end, these guys will chase a competitive seat to, you know, through hell. But how many guys have gone back into the F1 program at Red Bull? In a, like, Ricardo, you know, did through a roundabout way, but like, it's a driver pipeline that you'll never convince me there is not a text message support group among race drivers for guys who came through that program.
Yeah.
And I suspect that Sainz will, by inclination and just his read of the situation, feel that he can do better elsewhere.
Wow. Interesting. I don't know. I guess we shall see. All right. Well, stay tuned, everyone, for next week. We will be back with our pre-Japan primer. And if you would like to support the show in the meantime and get access to all of our bonus episodes, the ad-free version of the podcast, and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.